the war in Iraq, which is planned and will come unless we stop it, pretexts are offered. They're pretty hard to take seriously. I can come back to them if you like. But there certainly are reasons. One reason is the regaining control of the stupendous source of strategic power, at least this part of it, and the material prize. 9/11 gave a pretext for that. It's a long-standing goal. And domestic political considerations, the kind that I mentioned, they dictate the timing. It's got to be this winter. Can't wait another year. Because it has nothing to do with the mushroom cloud that Condoleezza Rice talks about. Nobody sane believes in that. But it has more mundane reasons. It has to do with the fact that there's going to be a presidential campaign. Karl Rove can figure it out. There is a security concern, a significant one, security imperative. But it's not securing the population from threat. It has to do with securing a domestic program, a program of service to very narrow and unusually corrupt sectors of corporate power, along with a continuing assault, on most of the population, which is very serious, and the pursuit of global dominance based on absolute military superiority. That has to be secured for another 4 years, so a war against Iraq makes sense. By next year, the next phase will probably be underway, maybe Iran. That war may have already started. The Israeli Air Force, which is not small, it's a small country, but remember it's a U.S. military base, which makes it a powerful country. Their own assessment, the IDF, the Israeli Army, their analysts assess their Air Force and Navy. They say that they are more powerful, they're larger and more technically advanced than any NATO power. About over 10% of them are now permanently based in eastern Turkey, where they're flying over at the Iranian border. They're based in these huge U.S. military bases in eastern Turkey, which are bases for nuclear-armed planes. And they're thinking about the next war, Iran. Iraq's over. The Egyptian press refers to what they call an axis of evil. They're referring to the U.S., Israel, and Turkey. It's not a bad usage. I mean, unlike the one invented by Bush's speechwriters, this is a real axis. Iran and Iraq have been at war for 20 years. It's not an axis. North Korea was tossed in to make it look as though it's not a war against Muslims. But this is a real axis, and there's plenty of evil to go around, and they're at work. Iran is a likely next target. And there's a much more far-reaching plans. You can read about them in U.S. scholarly sources, although the best place really is the Israeli press. It's generally quite reliable, and it's particularly informative now because of very close links between the high-level Bush planners and the extreme right in Israel. I'm not referring to Ariel Sharon, but the groups to the right of Sharon. So Richard Perle, his top planner, and Douglas Feith, another one, 5-6 years ago, they were writing position papers for Benjamin Netanyahu, who's to the right of Sharon. He's his right-wing critic, way out on the extreme. These plans are available. You can read about them. They're pretty frightening, and they're frightening even to U.S. military planners, the serious ones. Recently, we were highly, sharply criticized by one of the best-known of them, Anthony Cordesman, who's a strategic analyst, one of the most prestigious of them, who concentrates primarily on the Middle East, and he warned the government not to be caught up in the plan, I'm quoting him, in the plans of sillier armchair strategists and more vocally irresponsible hardliners. He's referring to Perle and Feith and others who are very close to the center of power, and Cordesman himself is about as hardline as you can get within any sector that retains some elements of sanity. And this, again, is another indication of why the world is so deeply concerned about U.S. power and its exercise. Well, there's a lot more to say about this, but my wife's watch tells me I should shut up. So I'll just end with the good news, and there is good news. The good news is that we are very highly privileged. We're not in a position of people like Archbishop Romero, who are going to be assassinated by U.S.-supported state terrorists. Or we're not like the people in two of the countries I just visited in the last few months, Turkey and Colombia. The scenes of some of the worst atrocities of the horrible 1990s still going on, all thanks to massive U.S. support, military, economic, and doctrinal. The doctrinal support comes from silence, so you don't read about it. We just contribute to the atrocities. And there are people there, you know, kind of like us, in fact, very prominent people, leading writers, artists, priests in Colombia, academics, human rights activists, who are constantly struggling very courageously for things like freedom of speech or for defense of people who are millions of people who are being subjected to vicious, miserable oppression and destruction, thanks to us. And they face dangers. They face assassination, like Archbishop Romero and not a few others. Prison and torture and other pretty serious consequences. We don't face any of this. We are uniquely privileged. We have the means to determine whether the ominous tendencies that are frightening the world will continue, or whether policy takes a different course, a more constructive course. And the enormous wealth and power that we have in our hands will be used to build instead of to destroy. Thanks. It's interesting that the same assumptions are made by military planners. And just to indicate how narrow the spectrum is, I'll take some from Clinton-era documents. So there's another public document, actually intended for the public, came out in 1997, published by Clinton's Space Command, called Vision for 2020. What do they expect to happen in 20 years? They predict a growing gap between the haves and the have-nots. The have-nots are going to have to be controlled. It's the same prediction as the National Intelligence Council about the consequences of deepening stagnation and a widening economic divide. And that's a good part of the thinking behind the vast expansion of U.S. military power. I mean, even before September 11th, it completely outweighed any possible combination of adversaries or allies. September 11th gave a pretext for a sharp increase, which is completely unrelated to terrorism, but is closely related to global dominance and to controlling the extremists who will follow from the stagnation and widening economic divide. The Visions document gives an interesting history of this. They point out that in the past, countries had to develop armies for self-defense. The example that they use is the United States, where the army was necessary in self-defense for the peaceful people who were spreading across the continent and taking over half of Mexico, and they had to be defended from the indigenous population who were expelling and exterminating, or those who were irrationally trying to keep Mexico. That's called self-defense, and that's why we needed armies. Then they point out that navies were needed to protect commercial interests and investments. Now there's a new frontier, space, so we got to militarize space to protect U.S. business interests and investments, and, of course, to control the growing number of have-nots as deepening stagnation fosters extremism and violence. That's the war on terror, which, of course, will be another terrorist war. The most ominous development is the militarization of space. It's worth point discussing. Again, not much time, but it is extremely dangerous. It might lead to total devastation, in fact, just by unintended accident. It's not unlikely, in fact. And again, the world is very frightened. There is an Outer Space Treaty, 1967, which bans military use of space. In the last couple of years, the United Nations General Assembly has been reaffirming the treaty. The reason is they know the U.S. intends to violate it. And that's approved unanimously with two opposed, the United States and Israel, which is really one opposed because Israel's become basically a U.S. military base. The same is true of the UN Disarmament Commission. Meets in the last couple of years, has been meeting the last Clinton years and since, trying to do the same thing, but can't get it through. The U.S. won't allow it. In fact, just last week, October 23rd, the United Nations, again, the First Committee, which is essentially the General Assembly, approved two resolutions. One was a resolution to ban weapons in space. A second was a resolution to reaffirm the 1925 Geneva Convention that bans chemical weapons. Once again, two countries opposed, the U.S. and Israel. They both abstained, and a U.S. abstention amounts to a veto, actually a double veto. For one thing, the decision is vetoed, and secondly, it's vetoed from the media and from history. And in fact, everything I've just described has been vetoed in the second sense. What happened last week, there was no report, as usual. And it's pretty serious, banning weapons in outer space and reaffirming a 1925 convention against chemical weapons. Highly timely, too. Takes some discipline to suppress all this. But the point is that editors and commentators probably understand, without anybody telling them, it's just not a good idea to allow citizens to know of plans that may bring to an end biology's only experiment with what's called higher intelligence. Well, a lot of this is disguised as missile defense, but defense, as usual, means offense, and everyone understands that. U.S. military analysts agree with Chinese military analysts that missile defense, quoting them, is not simply a shield, but it's also a sword. It's an enabler of action. Missile defense will provide the United States with absolute freedom in using or threatening to use force in international relations, cementing U.S. hegemony, and making Americans the masters of the world. Actually, I'm quoting military analysts in the liberal and conservative press. They're not very different. That's the reason behind the reasoning behind the national security strategy that was released a couple of weeks ago, and that seriously intensified the growing fears of the United States throughout the world. Well, let's come to the Middle East, which is the focus of present concern. What are the expectations there? The National Intelligence Council predicts a rising demand for energy, which they say will undermine the Kyoto Protocols, whether people sign them or not, and will lead to increased global warming. One of the main arguments for a war in Iraq, as I'm sure you know, is that once the U.S. regains control, it can increase production, lower prices, increase the rising demand, make sure there's twice as many cars on Milwaukee streets, and escalate the destruction of the environment. It's another threat to survival, but it's entirely rational within a lunatic framework. The National Intelligence Council, of course, talks about the Persian Gulf. They say the Persian Gulf region, that's Iraq and Saudi Arabia and Iran and so on, that will see large increases in oil production capacity and will rise in importance to world energy markets.